I'm Dr. Casey Mixon, Assistant Professor at Valdosta State University's Psychology, Counseling, and Family Therapy Department, and Project Director for the Military Families Learning Network Family Development Team. Along with Barry Sobelson, Licensed Family Therapist and MFLN Family Development Programming Coordinator, we invite you to join us for our anchored podcast conversations. We started this podcast in hopes to support and inspire those connected to military families. Each episode focuses on real-life struggles and practical solutions to lessen the harmful ripple effects. We invite you to sit back, relax, and get anchored with us.
Today, we have Dr. Irene, or Renee McClatchy, joining us. Renee is a licensed clinical social worker currently serving as an associate professor and director of the MSW program at Kennesaw State University. After an extensive sojourn in hospice, Renee developed children's bereavement groups and grief camps and designed new treatment tools for work with children experiencing grief. Renee left the clinical arena in 2003 to further her knowledge about children in grief through studies and research. In 2016, Casey and I attended the Military Social Work Conference in Austin, Texas, and had the opportunity to attend a session on children and parental loss with Renee as the facilitator. Her session prompted a desire to reach out to her and invite her to be a guest for this particular episode. And I have with me now Dr. Renee McClatchy. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you being here and talking with us. I would love for you to talk with us a little bit about how you became interested in this particular topic. Was there any specific motivation behind it?
Yes, there were a couple of things that led me to this work. I was born and raised in Sweden, and I was the 10th child of 11. So my parents were a little older when they had me. And as an adolescent, I lost my father suddenly to a heart attack. And that was very difficult for me. I know now that I experienced what we call post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, but I didn't know it then. I was devastated and felt very guilty because I had spent the last couple of years being very oppositional with my father, and I felt that that caused his heart attack. I also felt that I had a very limited time on this earth. A foreshortened future is what they call it in post-traumatic stress disorder. I interrupted my schooling and did not do what I had planned to do. And then if we fast forward, a couple of years later, I moved to the United States to marry an American. And I went to school to get my social work degree and started working at a hospice, which I did for several years. And when I was at the hospice, I met several children who lost their parent. And it was devastating to me to see their grief and loss and not have many resources to refer them to. So these two events in my life led me to wanting to become a resource to these kids. And it gave me the impetus to go back to school. So I went back to get my doctorate. And my research topic obviously was childhood grief. That's how I come to work with grieving children.
And that's a very powerful story that you share. And when was it, Renee, that you realized that you were experiencing those types of symptoms as a child? Was it when you went to work in hospice and started working with these children that it suddenly occurred to you that some of the experiences that you were having as a child were post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms?
Well, actually, it was before then, because 10 years after my father's loss, I finally sat down in a therapist's office. You know, I had felt so isolated when it happened and afterwards, but I got the bright idea to go to a therapist. And when I did, and I explained what I was experiencing, she helped me identify it. And the most helpful thing she ever did that changed my life forever was that she told me my rebellion and opposition as a teenager was actually quite normal developmentally, what I was supposed to do. That was my adolescent job. And that took a huge burden of guilt from my shoulders, and it was so simple. And we'll talk about it later when we get into some other questions, I imagine, about magical thinking. You think that what you did or say caused the death. That's very typical for children. In my case, I thought I caused it by being oppositional, but kids find all sorts of excuses to believe they made it happen.
Right. And how amazing that you had the intuition, or like you said, bright idea to go seek help, because I know that for a lot of people, that's something that they don't necessarily think about, or they feel like they don't need, or they don't deserve even.
Exactly. And I think for some too, it's a financial issue. I happen to have insurance that was covering it, so it was easy for me to do it. But still, it took me 10 years to figure out I needed to do it. So you're right.
And that's 10 years of a lot of weight on your shoulders that seemed, like you were saying, to have been resolved in a very short amount of time when the therapist was able to explain to you. I love what she said to you about that just being your adolescent job.
Yes. You know, that's why I want to work with these children as soon as possible after the loss. Of course, not too soon. They need a little time to grieve before they can share with a stranger. But I want to catch them before they go 10 years with
sure.
something that they don't need to carry.
And as you're talking about that, you had mentioned at the Military Social Work Conference, and then in a lot of work that you've done, you've talked about this idea of unresolved grief having serious consequences among children that can affect them for the rest of their lives if not attended to. And so I think that's kind of what you're hinting at. So what are the possible consequences of unresolved grief?
Well, in my case, it was severe depression, but there are lots of other severe consequences, difficulties in school, developmental delays, higher rates of substance abuse. There is also a very large study that came out from Scandinavia recently that showed that it does have increased risk of mortality in early adulthood. And then, you know, trust issues, difficulties in relationships. And that's only to name a few. And to look at combating the consequences, I think it's very important that we look at grief theory for children. And the one that I work with a lot is a fairly newly developed multidimensional grief theory that was developed by Kaplow, and she is at the University of Texas. And she and her colleagues have developed the multidimensional grief theory, where she talks about three types of distress, like separation distress, and existential distress, and circumstance-related distress, where you look at the three variables and you look how the child is faring in each one of those, and it can go from adaptive reactions to maladaptive. And for each one, there are different things that you can do. So, for instance, adaptive separation distress would be the typical what you expect, sadness and longing for the deceased parent, and very young children would not understand that the loss is permanent and they may wait for dad to come back home. But even very young children pick up on the emotions of adults in home, so they understand that something is wrong and they may temporarily regress or become clingy. And little older children may hold on to some belonging of the deceased, like a shirt or something like that. But the maladaptive, if we go to the other side of the spectrum, would be a more intense yearning that does not decrease, and you can even see suicidal ideation or behavior. And I talked about holding on to something that belonged to the deceased. If it's adaptive separation distress, then it becomes a very important object, but they can part with it at times. With maladaptive separation distress, they hold on to something and will not let it go. I had a 14-year-old that I was working with, and first time I saw her, she was wearing her dad's flannel shirt, which I thought was a way of keeping in touch with him. But then every time I saw her, she was wearing the same shirt, and then I find out that it's a struggle with mom every time to take it off for an hour to wash and dry it. So that would be a sign of maladaptive separation distress. So to help with this kind of distress, mourning rituals are important. You can light a candle for the deceased at dinner time, for instance, or plant a tree, send off a balloon with a message, share memories with each other about the parent who has lost, identify positive traits of that person, scrapbooks, and help them identify their feelings, because children and even older children, adolescents, have problems identifying feelings. And if they are not helped in that, then it oftentimes comes out in acting out behavior, or even the opposite. They withdraw and may overperform in school. Mm-hmm. And I'm not worried about the acting out child, because somebody will pay attention and say he or she needs help. It's the one that overachieves that everybody thinks she's doing well. You won't even know dad has died. She has all A's in school. That's the one I worry about, because nobody identifies her.
How interesting.
So then the other stress factor was the existential distress, where if it's adaptive, they will have the typical existential questions, but they're temporary. And the maladaptive, if we go to the other end of the spectrum, it doesn't subside. And they may also be jealous and resentful towards friends who still have their parents. And this is interesting, because obviously I had maladaptive existential distress, because I remember as a adolescent, I was so mad at my friends for having their parents. And if they mentioned their dad, I just didn't want to talk to them. I would feel guilty about it, but it helps to know that I was just quote-unquote normal in my maladaptive existential distress.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that happens a lot with children, where they don't want to hear stories about other people's parents because it's too painful for them to hear that.
Exactly. And I think when you assess a child, if it's maladaptive or adaptive, I think the adaptive, you know, it's normal, if we use that word, to feel sadness and regret that they don't have that child. But in the maladaptive, it's like you despise your friends for having a father and they can't help it.
Right. And then that obviously interferes with relationships, right? With being able to form quote-unquote normal relationships, which I'm sure can also help mitigate some of the negative consequences after the death of a loved one.
Yes, it definitely creates difficulty bonding with other people. And in maladaptive existential, you will also see that they may become overly clingy to people. And an adolescent may date a girl and just be so needy that it doesn't work out, mm-hmm. or may be so absent, the opposite, not being able to connect because they're afraid to, which also is not good for the relationship. So we try with those kind of things to help them engage with others as best they can, and also try to look at if there was anything positive that came from the loss, mm-hmm. like what have they learned about themselves, what strengths do they have, and do some internal looking.
Yeah, and that's obviously very important. I would love to talk about, during your session at the Military Social Work Conference, something that I noted that really hit home for me, especially because it was regarding military families. You talked at length about children who experience loss through severe injury of a parent and not just through a death per se. Can you expand on this for our listeners?
Yes. Yes. You know, grief does not only relate to death. We can grieve a lot of other things, you know, losing a job or divorce or breaking up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. So when a parent becomes severely injured or disabled, the parent, and by default the whole family, go through an identity reconstruction because the life they knew is no more. So there are psychological, existential, and spiritual shifts, but there are also concrete changes how daily life is lived. Mom or dad may now be in a wheelchair, for instance. So the child will most likely be given new responsibilities, and they may even have to do some caregiving of their parent. So they will grieve not only the person who their parent was that they have now lost, but also the life they used to have. So they may express that by being angry and resentful, often towards the parent, but again, also towards friends who don't have to go through this. And they will grieve activities they can no longer do with their parent. For instance, they may not be able to play softball, baseball, football, or mom may not be able to take them to cheerleading anymore. And that is not just for now, but also for their future. And if the parent is mentally impaired from an injury, they can communicate with a parent like they used to. And when you lose somebody the way they used to be, but they're still physically there, that's what we call ambiguous loss. And that is very confusing to the children. The person is here, but not the way they used to be. So they don't know how to grieve that specifically. And oftentimes it's also disenfranchised grief. And that's when the grief is not socially sanctioned, because let's say dad became disabled for a car accident and the child is grieving the fact that dad is not the way he used to be, but people don't support this loss because, well, father survived and they don't see that there's anything specific to grieve.
Sure. And that makes a lot of sense. And we actually did a webinar last year on the impact of traumatic brain injury on the family. And that was something that we covered, was this idea of ambiguous loss and how they may look perfectly fine on the outside. And so to others, and even to the children who are experiencing this loss, they're looking at the parent and they're going, this is the same parent that I had before. And they have trouble identifying the disconnect, which from my understanding only adds to the grief.
Right. It compounds it. And because they don't have that social support around the grief that they experience.
Sure. How would you recommend working with a family that has experienced this type of loss, an injury, an ambiguous loss?
I think you always have to communicate with your children. And of course, if dad is not able to, but mom is there, they need to talk about what has happened. And there's some interesting research emerging now that shows that ignoring what happens, whatever type of loss it is, or being overly emotional about the loss does not have good consequences for children. However, talking about it openly and being open to questions, and as a parent sharing your own grief and showing mild to moderate emotion, shows that that's very helpful to children, because if you show your emotions, that validates what they are feeling. Communication has shown to be one of the most important things to do when there is a loss.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking about this, I'm wondering if maybe they're showing their emotions and talking about the situation can serve as a model for them as well. So if it's somewhere in the middle where it's not ignoring, but it's not being overly emotional, as you stated before, it's serving as a nice model for them to be able to process and talk about their emotions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In a healthy way, I guess.
Yes, That's exactly it. You show them a good model for how to grieve, and also it validates their feelings. When you show no emotions, for instance, the child will feel that they are rejected and they think they did something wrong, which does not help magical thinking, because most kids and even adolescents and even adults, I have found, have what we call magical thinking. They think there is something they did or said that caused the loss or the death. So if you nag dad to go and buy ice cream and he did, and then he was shot in the minute mark when he did it, the child will feel, well, I'm the one that asked for the ice cream, so it's my fault. And they are not going to share that freely, because if I admit that it's my fault, then everybody will know it's my fault. So it's something you always have to reassure children that it's nothing they said or did that caused this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I think even older children feel this, and I think adults experience it. I think when something happens that we can't explain, we try to make sense out of it, and we try to make sense of something that does not make sense or has any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you take on the blame and said, this is because I said this, or this is because I did this, or because I didn't do this, then I think that explains it. So now you have an explanation.
Right.
And even though that creates guilt, you need that explanation somehow.
That makes a lot of sense, especially around a topic like death, which is so hard for so many of us to be able to wrap our minds around, and loss, not just death.
I just was thinking back, we talked about separation distress and existential distress, but there's also the third variable there, which is the circumstance-related distress, and that's when somebody obsesses about how the person died. And that is best dealt with a clinician or somebody who has more experience. But there are some things parents can do too. We have found that when somebody experienced, for instance, post-traumatic stress disorder over how a person died, that mindful breathing is helpful, relaxation exercises. So that's something that can happen at home together with the other parent or guardian.
So this third variable, is it just kind of a perseveration of the details of how they died, or can you elaborate on it just a little bit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it could be perseveration over how the details unfolded. That can be one sign. It can also be somebody who totally avoids speaking about it. They will go to great lengths not to speak about it. Or it could be somebody who have what we call hypervigilance, where they are constantly on the lookout for something else to happen. Mm-hmm. And I know that when I experienced the loss of my father, I just knew something else was happening. Something really bad was going to happen, and it was going to happen anytime soon. So you can't relax. Interestingly enough, when my father died from a heart attack, he was older, like I said in the beginning. So thoughts of my parents dying were on my mind probably more than most kids growing up. And when he died from a heart attack, it was not only the fact that I had acted out that contributed to his death. It was also the fact that I had thought he might be dying. So there I had the magical thinking in double dose.
Wow, yeah.
But for most kids, it's not on the radar.
Right.
It may happen to others, but it doesn't happen to them. And then when it does happen to them, it's a devastating event.
And while we're on this subject, I think that's a really nice little segue to my next question, which is, in previous conversations that you and I have had, you've mentioned something that I feel is pretty important to address. You explain that there are many instances when children experience the loss of a parent and are then found under the care and or guardianship of their grandparents. This new arrangement can cause new worries and stressors to the lives of these children, as they become then fearful that they will lose their grandparents as well because of their age.
Yes. Well, you know, custodial grandparenting, or it's also called skipped generation parenting, that affects hundreds of thousands of bereaved children. And one thing that I have noticed, and it's also documented in the research, is that this number is increasing. And one reason is, you know, the opioid crisis mm-hmm. that we are experiencing. And when grandchildren get custody of the grandchildren, that's difficult for them because of many reasons. One is that they're older and they have to take time away from their friends. So they experience isolation, and there's economic hardship. Actually, many grandparents who raise their grandchildren live below the poverty line. And then, of course, the grandparent may experience depression because they're grieving the loss of their child. And that's often thought of as the worst kind of grief imaginable. So that makes it difficult, and they may have health problems. And all this is in addition from having to change the role from being grandparent to parent and negotiate boundary setting and discipline issues. So this often spills over into raising the grandchildren. And for the children, moving in with the grandparents often means that they have to relocate. So they not only grieve the loss of the parent, but they lose friends and teachers and support systems where they used to live. So one thing that, you know, all these factors compound the adjustment of the child, but one thing that becomes more salient is the fact that the grandparent is older, and to children, we know that old people seem very old. So if they have lost the parent, then it's obvious to them that it could happen again, and they worry about who will take care of them, and it becomes overwhelming. And it is very important that we explain to children, whether we are grandparents or regular parents, that when a child worries about the health or the survival of the other parent, that we are honest with them. Yes, it could happen to me too. Mm-hmm. Everybody dies. Parents have a tendency to protect their children and say, oh, don't worry about it. Nothing is going to happen to me.
Sure.
Well, the children are too smart. They know that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be honest, and you have to tell them, yes, this could happen to me. However, I plan to live a long time. I plan to see my grandchildren be born. But should something happen to me, this is who will take care of you. Children need to know what the backup plan is.
Yeah.
And with grandparents, that's even more important. It's always important, of course. But I remember I had a child who had lost his father to gun violence, and he was raised by his grandparents. And when I saw him, his biggest worry was, what would he do if something happened to his grandparents? and he was very close with them. But when I met the grandfather, it was very obvious that grandfather was in ill health. And so we did talk about what was going to happen if grandfather died, grandmother was going to take care of him. Well, what if grandmother died? So the family came up with a plan. So that was the father's friend was going to raise him. You know, that was plan C. And indeed, a year later, he came back and his grandfather had died. So we went over that again. And of course, we did a lot of other things too. But one thing we did was remind him of the backup plans, and they were still in place. So that if grandmother didn't live till he became an adult, then there was somebody else to do it. So with grandparents, you probably will have to have plan B and plan C.
Mm-hmm. And that, I'm sure, is very comforting to a child, even though it's hard to hear. I'm sure that it's comforting to know that there are plans being made for you, mm-hmm. backup plans.
Yes, it tells the child that you have thought about this and that they will be taken care of.
Sure. Yeah, and having those conversations with them, like you said, just being honest with them and straightforward with them. And probably kind of going back to the research that you were discussing that's emerging, where you were saying it's not okay to ignore it and it's not okay to be overly emotional about it. But again, being somewhere in the middle, just talking about the possibilities and being honest with them, I'm sure it's very helpful to them.
You know, I encourage parents to cry with their children. It's just that they can't get so emotional that the child has to take care of them.
Right, right.
And that leads to another thing that I always suggest to parents, and that is let your child know they are not responsible for your feelings, because children said, oh, I can't talk about mom because dad starts crying.
Mm-hmm.
But to let them know it's okay for you to talk about that, or mom, I will talk to you about mom, and it's okay if I'm crying, but you're not responsible for that. I'm crying because I'm sad that we lost her.
Right.
And then add, if it gets too difficult for me, I can talk to grandpa. So that you identify an adult that is helping you through this, so that the child knows that they are not responsible.
And they're not taking on the role of this caregiver.
Right. You know, that's another thing that often happens with children. They get parentified,
mm-hmm.
which means that they get responsibilities that they're too young for. I had one 10-year-old that was calculating how many years it would be before he could start working at McDonald's. Because if he started McDonald's, he would make this much a day, and then he could give his mother this much money to help with the rent. And, you know, they were moving from extended stay motel to extended motel just because they didn't have enough resources. So, you know, I encourage parents not to talk financial stress with the children, because that's an adult's problem and not something that kids need to take on. But, you know, they're often parentified in other ways, too. You are now the man of the house. And that's a big, big responsibility for a little guy.
Yeah.
So I think people are saying it meaning well, but children are very literal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Taking on a lot, for sure. I'm glad that you brought that up. So you've designed new treatment tools for children experiencing grief, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about them and who can use them. So are we talking parents or family members, friends or professionals?
Well, I have developed a six-session curriculum that I use at a grief camp I do that can also be used at individual sessions, but that would be for a clinician to use, because that goes over storytelling and identify feelings and coping strategies, but also cognitive behavioral therapy, where we try to change the magical thinking. So that curriculum is for professionals. And then I also have developed a board game that children roll the dice and then they land on a particular color and they have to draw a card from that color stack. And half of the questions or commands are serious and half are related to more funny or silly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So an example of a serious question might be, what would it be like if dad started dating again?
Mm-hmm.
They draw that card and they hand it to the facilitator so that they can customize it. So if it's dad or mom start dating again, so then they can talk about feelings around that. And then an example of a silly command could be, stand on one leg and sing happy birthday in your best Donald Duck voice. So the premise behind it is to help kids express their feelings in a non-threatening way, but also to mix the serious with the fun activities, because children can't tolerate strong feelings for a long period of time.
Sure.
So that's why you see a child crying one moment and then they're playing happily the next.
Mm-hmm. You were saying you would recommend school counselors use this board game?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And that maybe some parents could use it, but with some guidance.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. And some of our listeners out there are service professionals and probably are just as curious as I am about this curriculum. And without going into too much detail, would you like to just kind of give a brief overview of your curriculum?
So it is built into six sessions. And the first session, the kids meet and they shortly tell their story, an abbreviated narrative. We don't go into too much detail, but everybody wants to know who they lost and what they died from. And we talk about causes of death. Cancer causes death, suicide, gunshots. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the beginning of trying to get rid of the magical thinking. And then in the next session, we help them identify feelings and go over positive coping strategies. We have a backpack routine where they carry rocks around, and then when they open the backpack, the rocks have feelings on them, and they talk about when they felt those feelings and how they cope with those feelings. And then the group together kind of utilize some of those positive coping strategies. At one camp session, I had a visitor pull up at noon on Saturday, and she heard kids screaming in one end, and then 5 seconds later in another end of camp, and then a third place. And she says, "What's going on here?" She thought we were abusing children. And what happened was they were acting out a coping skill, and one coping skill is scream loud in the woods.
Yeah.
So each group was doing it at different times, and she was wondering what was going on.
And she just happened to come in at that time.
Yes. She couldn't see the kids, but she could hear them. So we go over the coping strategies. They come up with a list that they write down in their journals. And the basic rule is it's something that doesn't hurt you or anybody else or anybody's property. And then the next session, we do an in-depth narrative where the children go over their story, beginning, middle, and end. And they get to do this in a uninterrupted way. We don't want to interrupt with questions while they tell the story. But after it's told, if any of the other group members or the group leader have questions, they can ask those then. And we go over the perfect moment, which is another coping strategy, mm-hmm. where they come up with a perfect moment in life. And it cannot include the person who died, because that may trigger thoughts of the death. But a perfect moment, such as maybe it is scoring a winning soccer goal, or maybe it is winning the gold in curling in the Olympics. So that when they are in a situation where they need to focus, but all they can think about is the death of their dad, they can replace that thought with the perfect moment and go on with what they need to do. It may be a test they have in school or something like that. And we go over how thoughts create feelings, and feelings lead to behavior, and how we can change our thoughts. So if we talked about the dad who went to the minute mark to buy ice cream, so instead of thinking it was my fault because I asked for the ice cream, we can change that thought to dad is an adult who decided to go to the minute mark to buy ice cream, and it was the person who pulled the trigger who was the cause. And that changes how we feel. It doesn't take away our sadness or grief.
Sure.
But it can take away the guilt.
Yeah.
That's what we do in that session. And then we follow that with a memory session where they can talk about positive memories about the person who died. Children often think that if they stop thinking about mom, they're going to forget her. But by writing down or drawing memories, we can go on and think about other things at times. We don't have to think about it all the time.
I'm sure that takes away some burden and responsibility as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that they are free to do what kids are supposed to do, which is play and have fun and learn and go to school. And
Right. And
then we have a final session, which is the letter writing session, where they write a letter to the deceased. And that's an opportunity for them to tell their dad or mom or the person that had died what's happening now and how they're feeling, and it gives them a chance to say they're sorry if they think there is something they are sorry for. I had a 14-year-old that said the letter writing was the best thing ever because when his dad died, he was at home. He had just gone to bed, but they had bought lottery tickets. So he woke up at 10 o'clock, mom screaming, and he thought, oh, we won the lottery. And of course, he finds out that his dad is having a heart attack and mom is trying to resuscitate and he has to call the ambulance. But that night, when he came home before his dad died, dad had asked if he got his report card. And he said, no. Oh, okay, well, let me know when you get it. Well, he had gotten his report card, and it was not good. And for some reason, that became the reason dad died.
Wow.
So, well, they're creative. Children are creative.
Yeah.
And he said, writing that letter and telling him the truth, that I had a bad report card, and telling him I was sorry I lied to him, he said that took all my guilt away.
Wow.
So the letter writing, you know, it's good to keep connection, but if they have something, it gives them an opportunity to say they're sorry. And I can tell you that the therapist I went to after my father died, that was one of the first things he had me do. So then we also asked them to write a letter from the person who died, imagining what they would tell them. So that can also be very powerful. But
sure,
some children don't want to do that. Others jump at the chance, but it just kind of keeps a little connection. And this is something they, of course, these are letters are unsent, but that's something they can keep doing, keeping the loved one updated on how they're doing and imagine what they would think about it.
Yeah, that's really neat. And as you're telling me, Rini, about this curriculum, and you've kind of taken us through the 6 different sessions, I'm realizing that it's very much like the board game that you created, where there's this nice balance of serious and heavy stuff, and then maybe some things that can bring a smile to their face, too. And,
yeah.
And I love that. It just seems like a very lovely approach to something so heavy.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. While we're on the topic, why don't we talk about your grief camps?
Yes. The first camp was held in 1995, and what grief camp is, we rent a camp location for a weekend, and children come Friday night and stay through Sunday afternoon. And these are children who have a lost parent or a sibling. And during the weekend, they get to participate in the curriculum that I just described, the 6 counseling sessions. And in between the sessions, we do all the fun camp activities. We do a ropes course, we do canoeing, we do a talent show. We also very fortunate to have a play and a puppetry show performed. And together, in collaboration with Kaiser Permanente Educational Theater Group, they have a creative director there that I contacted. They have a lot of preventive shows that they do in the schools, but they didn't have anything on grief. So she asked me what I wanted included in the play and puppetry show as far as reactions. And of course, I wanted magical thinking, and I wanted, you know, different things addressed. And she created 2 wonderful pieces, a play for the adolescents and a puppetry show for the younger ones. So we have that at camp. Also, parents and guardians who are experiencing their own loss or grief can stay for the weekend. So we have an adult camp at the same time. And these adults are separate from the kids, but it's parallel, so they are at the same time. And that is very helpful, I think, for the family if both get support and education around grief.
Absolutely. And what's the camp called?
It's called Camp Magic, and we spell it wrong. We spell it Magic with a K, and it stands for Mainly About Grief in Kids.
Oh, I love that. It sounds to me like it's spelled absolutely correctly.
Well, maybe so. But we hold it 3 weekends a year, and right now we have 1 site in northwest Georgia, 1 little bit south of Atlanta, and 1 in the Athens area. So we try to reach as many campers as we can.
Sure, absolutely. If someone was interested in learning about your camp, in becoming a camper, how would they find out more?
They can go to our website, which is www.campmagic.org, and not forget to spell magic with a K.
And then, Rini, who staffs your camp?
Okay, so for the weekend, we hire professional grief therapists. So they lead the 6 counseling sessions, but they also join the kids throughout the weekend. They eat with them, they sleep with them, they go canoeing with them, because oftentimes kids may not bring up the issue in the session. It may come at another time, and especially at bedtime. But I specifically remember we had a camper who was 8, and she had actually come home and found mother shot by her father, and she didn't know what to do. So it was several hours before the grandparents came, wondering why they weren't answering the phone, and the then 7-year-old, what she was doing was trying to clean up the blood. But from then on, she did not speak. And she came to a camp a year later and had not spoken. She didn't speak in class. They had taken to individual therapy. She didn't speak. She came to camp and was part of everything, but she did not speak in the first group session, didn't speak in the second group session. After the third group session, when everybody was canoeing, she grabbed her counselor's hand and he said, "Well, honey, we're going canoeing. What do you need to do?" Mm-hmm. You know, it dawned on him that something was going on.
Sure.
So she went back in the cabin and took out a piece of paper and wrote a letter to Dad. "Dear Dad, I hate you." And then ended it with, and she wrote some things, and then she ended it with love and her name. Mm-hmm. So the interesting part was that she had learned that these feelings were normal. She was angry at her dad for killing her mom, but she also loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And that had created such a conflict within her. She just, I guess that's why she couldn't speak. I mean, the shock of it all. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why she couldn't speak.
Sure.
But she wrote that letter and put it in her little journal, went canoeing and started talking.
Wow.
So things happen outside of the counseling session.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the counselors are with them the whole time. And then each, what we call lead counselor, has 2 co-counselors that help them out, help them watch the kids, help them in group if somebody starts crying to comfort that kid and things like that. And these are oftentimes students. I do work as a professor at the university, so I have some social work students, or lots of them, that come and become co-counselors. We have school counselors, we have teachers, and we have what we call regular folks too.
That's wonderful.
That serve as co-counselors.
That's wonderful. And Rainey, if someone who's listening to this might be interested in helping in some way, how would they go about contacting you?
They can also go to the website, and there is a tab that asks "Help Us." And if you click on that, a volunteer application pops up. And once we have that application, they can fax it, mail it, scan it, and email it. Once we have that application, we contact them and see how they want to help.
Fantastic. Okay. And again, that's www.campmagic.org. This has been just so interesting, and I feel like we could continue to talk forever. But I do have one last question that I want to ask you. So grief and loss obviously can be such a difficult topic for everyone, and so many people are afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing, or they don't want to bring it up. And I know that there may be some listeners out there who feel this way. Can you talk to us a little bit about appropriate ways to handle this sensitive topic? And then do you have ways to assist with that fear of saying or doing the wrong thing?
Well, you know, I often tell people when they ask or say, "I don't know what to say." Well, say just that. A bereaved child needs support. So a pat on the shoulder saying you're sorry shows that you care, but you don't want to question a child about their loss. But if they talk, you need to listen. So acting if nothing happened is confusing, and that invalidates what the child is feeling. And if you know the parent, you may want to add that you're sorry and you knew their dad and he was a good man or friend or whatever positive thing you can think of. But having said that, there are a couple of things that I strongly recommend that you do not say, and that is, "I know how you feel." Even if you lost a parent when you were a child, you don't know how this child feels unless you ask or they tell you. "Even though I lost my father to a heart attack, I don't know what it's like for some other child to lose their father to a heart attack. I don't know the relationship with their dad. I don't know the circumstances."
Sure.
And then I also encourage that they don't say, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. That's a hard one. And if a child is questioning existence and God and all that, that's just going to create more anger towards God. You know, and the other one we had already talked about, now you're the man or the woman of the house. Mm-hmm. That's not helpful. They're too young for those responsibilities. But basically, I think don't be afraid to say you don't know what to say and then listen. I think the best thing you can do for anybody who's grieving, child or adult, is to be there to listen. And don't come with your own story. That can come later.
Well, Reenie, it has been a true pleasure talking to you. And I just appreciate you being here and sharing such wisdom with us on such a heavy and sometimes difficult topic. Anything else that you wanted to talk to us about that maybe I did not cover in my questions or in our conversation?
Well, I mean, I think you asked the question, but I feel there are some more tips I can get out for parents and guardians.
Okay.
We talked about always being honest and avoid parentification and things like that. Children do crave structure and discipline. So if they think they're in charge, that's scary for them. So I encourage parents to whatever structure they had before the death and whatever discipline they had, if they can keep that as much as possible, or if they have a different kind of discipline than dad had, well, use the discipline though, because they feel that they need the adults to be in charge. I will have a mother in a group saying, I can't come down on him. He lost his dad. And then we have the 16-year-old speaking to his counselor and says, I wish he would lower the boom. They are going to fight it with every ounce of their body, but they do not want to win the fight. And then also take care of yourself. If you tell them that you plan to be around for a long time, take care of yourself. Children see their mother or dad smoke and that worries them. Mm-hmm. And you know, especially if there is substance use too, then that really worries them. And it doesn't have to be too extravagant, because I had a camper I talked to about a month after camp. His father had stayed the whole weekend too, so he had gotten a lot of these tips. And I said, well, how are you doing? And he said, well, I'm doing much better. We used to have McDonald's for dinner every night, but now dad cooks vegetables once a week. Yeah, you know, it didn't have to be fancy, right?
Yeah.
He knew that vegetables are good for you. So, you know, go to your doctor's appointments. Do take care of yourself, because that shows children that you do plan to be around.
Sure.
And I guess I wanted to mention suicide. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Please.
Okay. So among grief counselors, we don't say commit suicide anymore, because that indicates that it is a crime, and it isn't a crime in this country. So instead, we try to say died from suicide, completed suicide. And just like you die from cancer, a person does not commit cancer. And suicide is based in a mental illness, depression. So we try to say died from suicide. And if this is what happened to a parent, the child needs to know this. It was an illness. And it was not because the parent didn't love them, because people die from cancer no matter how loved they are, and the same with suicide. But by not telling your children, you will create problems. You're not protecting your child. Instead, they feel like you lied to them, and that's going to create anger issues. And they may also develop trust issues, and that's going to be hard to repair. And children can handle the truth.
I think that's really important, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Reenie, but I think that that's probably applicable to any sort of death, especially pertaining to our military families. Instead of just saying they died while defending their country or they died overseas, they may need a little bit more detail than that.
Yes, give them as much detail as you have, because that helps the children make sense of what happened, instead of having to go for weeks or months trying to figure out how it happened. If you have the details. It doesn't mean that you have to tell a little young child that they stabbed his eyes out or something like that. You don't have to do that, but give as much detail as is age appropriate for the child, because they are going to question
Well, I think that's a very important tip. And I think that's one that we can all use as service providers and professionals and as parents and as just people who are looking out for the well-being of children in general.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Reenie, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And I hope it's helpful.
It's been fantastic.
Good.
In this episode, Reenie touched on so many important aspects of helping children with parental loss and the process of grieving that children often experience. Towards the end of the episode, Reenie mentioned that among grief counselors, committing suicide is no longer an expression that is used because it indicates that it is a crime. Instead, they are using expressions like died from suicide or completed suicide. We felt that this was an incredibly important point. In fact, in September of 2018, we will be releasing episode 15 titled On the Edge, Connectivity Within Suicide Awareness, Assessment, and Prevention with Allie Martinez and Douglas Flemons. Here is a brief clip of Allie discussing her thoughts on this piece around language.
It's been a very interesting conversation recent years that really looking at how we language suicide, and I think it's an important one. And I do agree that we need to be very aware of how we language issues around crisis and suicide and mental health. Because for so long, I think that the stigma and the shame and some of the judgment around it, that I don't think necessarily came from, wasn't ill-intended. I trust that people are always trying their best to connect and understand. But I think that there has been language in the past used around those issues that can carry a bit more judgment and stigma, such as committing suicide. And so I think really looking at and reevaluating how we language things, how we talk about it, I think is important.
Please don't forget to tune in September to hear more. You can find more details on episode 15 and all of the other episodes on our website and in iTunes.
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you'd like to hear more episodes from Anchored, check out the links provided on our website, or you can go directly to iTunes. Just enter MFLN Anchored Podcast in your search engine to get you there. We offer continuing education credits for most of our programming. Information about that can be found on our website, or you can just email our team at mflnfamilydevelopment@gmail.com. We hope you will join us next time. This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy. U.S. Department of Defense award number is 2015-48770-24368.